Hi, I'm Roy Spencer of PermaSeal. For over 45 years, we've helped over 500,000 homeowners make their homes drier, healthier, and more valuable. Our warranties are transferable and estimates are free. Call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
With 2 weeks left, with America deciding whether it will be a Marxist state or whether it will be land of the free, even with MSNBC, we don't know what will happen. But we do know that Charles Lipson, professor emeritus, University of Chicago, our friend, excellent writer and analyst, is our guest on the Chicago Way podcast today. And where are you? As the leftists of MSNBC melt down in anxiety and fear, as the Mayor Johnson and all the rest clap their hands in unison for Kamala Harris, who doesn't seem to be paying much attention, and as Israel tries to protect itself against aggressors, Hamas, Iran, Hezbollah. And where are you? You're with WGN producer Jeff Carlin and John Cass, editor of johncassnews.com, and Charles Lipson, professor emeritus, University of Chicago, on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
So this is a guy who lives high on the hog, and he has this Tammany Hall style attitude to power. And it's the Chicago Way, absolutely.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
The Chicago Way. That's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
As promised, our guest is known for his cutting insight into all things politics. He is Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago, the Peter Ritzma Chair. He's written a series of articles that I just love them. Kamala Harris has sabotaged her own campaign in the Telegraph. What follows Sinwar's death in Israel's war in Gaza and beyond. And CBS, from the Tiffany Network to the cheap discount bin. You can read all his stuff if you go to charleslipson.com. As promised, Charles, what is going on with Kamala Harris?
She is a kind of Rorschach candidate that, you know.
That's brilliant.
And I think you're allowed to read into Kamala Harris a lot of what you want to read into her. That's a good strategy if you're a new politician who's running as an outsider. When Barack Obama ran on hope and change, that could mean one thing to you, John, and one thing to you, Jeffrey, sure. And a different thing to me. But Kamala is the incumbent vice president. And of course, Trump, who is in many ways running as an outsider, he has served as president, but he's not running as an outsider in the conventional sense. He's running as an outsider to the federal government. And she is the consummate insider. It looks to me, the polls say that they're tied with a little over 2 weeks to go. And the question there, there are two main questions, I would say. One, in the past, the polls, the only polls that matter are really the ones for the seven big toss-up states.
Right.
But the question that matters is whether the pollsters have managed to deal with a problem that they had in the last two presidential elections, which is that they underestimated Trump's vote, perhaps because it was harder to reach his people, perhaps because they were harder to predict whether they would turn out, perhaps because those respondents were less willing to tell somebody on the phone who they would vote. Who they were going to vote for. And then the second major point is that it looks like the trend is in Trump's favor. But all the races, according to the polls, are really within about a point. So it's hard to know how that'll all turn out.
One thing we've noticed, an interesting phenomenon of late, of the past few days, are all these Democrats running for the Senate and the Congress who are embracing Trump. They're embracing Trump policies. The fellow in Kerry in Pennsylvania grasping Trump's knees. Oh, I love your policy on tariffs and so forth. And even the woman from what's her name? Tammy Baldwin from Wisconsin. I'm waiting to see if John Tester will, you know, offer some jerky, some venison jerky to Trump, and because they're constantly sucking up. And I don't know, what is that, an attractive trait? Like, is treachery an attractive trait, modern trait?
Well, there's an ad for Bob Casey, who is running, I think, for a fourth term in Pennsylvania. And the screenshot that I'm looking at says, Casey supports Trump trade order. In the case of Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin and Alyssa Slotkin in Michigan, Baldwin running for re-election in the Senate, and Slotkin, who is a rep running for Debbie Stabenow's open seat, they have both said, in their advertisements, not just in, you know, talking to Charlemagne the God or something, that they support particular policies. In Tammy Baldwin's case, one of her ads says, Tammy Baldwin got President Trump to sign her Made in America bill. If you believe that, I've got a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you. Signing these nationalistic trade bills, you can think they're good or bad, but that's the beating heart of his nationalistic America First agenda. There's no way that and he would have signed those if Tammy Baldwin had never been born. Alyssa Slotkin saying that she passed a law with President Trump, this is in her ad, that shows patients the pharmacy with the lowest price. Now, that's really allying herself. Now, all these candidates want, and by the way, Sherrod Brown is doing the same thing in Ohio, but there, all these candidates certainly want a Harris victory, Kamala Harris victory, and they want to do something that's increasingly rare in American politics, is that they want split ticket voting. They want somebody to say, okay, in Pennsylvania, I'm going to vote for Trump for president, but I'm going to vote for Bob Casey for Senate, or in Wisconsin, I'm going to vote for Tammy Baldwin for Senate, even though I'm voting for Trump. So I think that's their goal. And what they're implying is that they won't oppose Trump when he's in office. Once again, I've got a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you.
It's interesting. It's wacky times, right? Where we are and what we've been seeing in the news and the everything. I mean, just listening to her try to put things together, listening to him sometimes ramble around. I mean, we've talked about this before, but how do we get here? These are the two best candidates we could find, 300 plus million people. You had a piece a couple of weeks ago about what happens if there's a tie. You know, what happens if it comes down is so razor thin. And it's an interesting thing. Can you lay out again what the the ramifications there. I mean, we could have a case where we would have a Kamala Vance or a Trump Walls situation kind of thing going on.
Well, if there's a tie in the Electoral College, which could happen, they're an even number, and it's possible that both could get 269 and you need 270 to win. It's very unlikely, but it could happen. And it could happen just with the toss-up states breaking in a in one way rather than another. If that happens, the election for the president of the United States goes to the House and the vice president goes to the Senate. Now, the House does not vote as it normally would vote on a regular bill. So rather, it votes by state delegation. So the Illinois state delegation, which is Democratic, would vote as a single vote. And they would, of course, vote for Kamala Harris. And the Texas delegation would vote as a single vote. And by the way, this gives a heavy weight, you know, a disproportionate weight to a small state. So Illinois would have the same vote as Vermont. But I think right now there are 28 Republican states and 22 Democratic states. The Senate, every senator votes individually. And by the way, these would be the new Senate and the new House, the one that is elected in November the 5th. And so it is possible if the Democrats still control the Senate, I think that's unlikely, but it would be possible to have a Democratic president and a Republican vice president or vice versa.
Right.
So I think that's very unlikely, but it could happen. Let me go back, if you don't mind, to this Casey Baldwin, Slotkin, Sherrod Brown. I think, and their ads, I think that it means that they've reached four fundamental conclusions. The first one, and most obvious, is that Trump has an excellent chance of winning their states. And the second is that if that is so, it is unwise for them to link their candidacies too closely to Kamala Harris. Now, if they have machines in that state and everything, those machines will be trying to get out Democratic votes for them and for Kamala Harris. But publicly, they don't want to link themselves too closely because of the independent vote and maybe some liberal Republicans. The third is that they actually have a chance to win some of these crucial split ticket votes, that there might be enough in a very close race to give them the edge. And the final point is that they will win more votes. This is their calculation. They will win more votes with that friendly to Trump message than they will lose amongst staunch Democrats who just hate Trump, because those people are going to turn up and vote for Kamala Harris and pull a straight Democratic ticket anyway, is their thinking. But that's their calculation. Those are their four calculations. But I think they wouldn't be doing these kinds of ads unless their internal polling gave them news that has to be very disturbing to the Harris campaign.
You know, I used to want to listen to people that I agree with. Mm-hmm. So I would, you know, I'd skip, never listen to Hannity, but I would listen to Laura Ingraham and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I've come to the realization that it's much more entertaining now that I'm not smoking to see the panic on MSNBC. I'm enjoying the panicking, like with Jonathan Capehart and so forth. I can't believe that this person is actually paid a salary to think the way he's thinking. Like, Trump's a dictator. He's going to come for us. He's going to lock us up. What is that? What is going on with this hysteria? And is that hysteria part of what happens when your side loses the election that you've been whipping people up for years about?
I think it's more. I think it's that and one thing more. I think they really fear Trump. And I don't think that their talk about him being a potential dictator and locking them all up and everything, I think that's crazy talk. But I think they actually believe it, or believe it to some extent, believe it could happen. And I've actually, I was at a dinner with a number of very well-educated and quite wealthy Democrats. These are people who are top lawyers at the biggest firms in the world, you know, that sort of thing. And they sounded like a guy at the end of the bar in terms of they were just livid about Trump. They said, as best I can recall, not a single positive word about Kamala Harris. She didn't enter into the conversation. They would have voted for a raccoon over Donald Trump. I mean, but these were, and they really did talk about dictatorships, and January 6th played a big role in their talking and so forth. And I actually thought that Trump's refusal to acknowledge the election, even if he thought he was cheated out of it, I thought that that was damaging to the country. But what I thought these people didn't get was that if you think a potential president would color outside the lines of the Constitution, then the thing that prevents that are strong constitutional institutions, the Senate, the House, and yes, the courts. But they have engaged in a century plus long effort to undermine those very institutions because they thought they were in political control and could and were willing to undermine them to achieve their policy goals. So they want to, they're the ones who are threatening to add people to the Supreme Court so they can get the outcomes they want. They're the ones who want to blow up the filibuster. Did do so. The reason the conservative justices are there is that Harry Reid blew that up to get a few justices, a few lower level judges when he was in power. And so I think that they have, and then they're the ones who are conducting lawfare. But when I ask them about the lawfare, they think all of that is just absolutely fine and not lawfare at all. It's just enforcing the laws of the land.
That's why the law's there, Charles.
So I think there's a contradiction.
Do they also think that if a state is arguing that you should not allow illegals to vote, that that's somehow anti-constitutional?
I didn't ask on that question. I wanted to actually get through the end of the meal. But I would say this: these are not people who use the word illegal,
right?
These are undocumented people, right. And I don't know, and they might have known better than I. About what state law permits, whether state law permits people who are not in the country legally. But, I mean, look at this thing with a voter ID, which you haven't heard as much about this time around as you did in previous elections, because now everybody has an ID, and how patronizing it was that black people couldn't figure out how to get an ID. You know, I mean, it's just paternalism in its worst form, but you needed one and you needed a lot of evidence to get one to go to the Democratic convention and to go to any talks by Kamala Harris. You need IDs.
But it's racist, according to Obama, the great one, if people, black people, are expected to have IDs. It's sort of unreasonable pressure on the vote, on the right to vote.
Yeah, well, but that's just the latest point, which was true in some places in the past in the segregationist South. If the law may have not even mentioned blacks, but you had to pass reading tests, you had to pay a poll tax. There were efforts in the past, but those efforts are gone. And what they're trying to do is not only increase the vote, including maybe by people who shouldn't be voting, right, but they're trying to rev up the identity politics that is the very heart of the Democratic Party. On Obama, I want to say something that I don't think anybody has said. You know how great comedians like, let's say, Jerry Seinfeld was a stand-up comedian and very, very successful. Then he did The Seinfeld Show, and then he did Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee and so forth. But when he decided to go back to performing as a stand-up, he went to small clubs because he had to get his timing back. And I must say, he wasn't very good. And I've heard this from other comedians. You just need to practice. And the same is true. There's a reason why there's preseason in football every year and so forth. And what you saw with Bill Clinton and Barack Obama was just like these comedians who haven't practiced very much. They come out and they say what's on their mind, but what's on their mind is what a columnist years ago, Michael Kinsley, once called a Washington gaffe, which is when you accidentally tell the truth.
Yeah. And now what? Now we have Barack Obama. We just had a new columnist at John Cass News called. He calls himself Tony Resco's groundskeeper.
Brilliant, by the way, I love it.
And he complained that Obama, living in his mansions, would walk along the beaches in sort of a barefoot with skinny white jeans and a. Mm-hmm. And a white shirt open to the navel, and on a Netflix, mm-hmm. Teaser. And then he would, as soon as he did that, he could go and felt energized about re-shaming black men, brothers from the neighborhoods. And I thought,
because it's identity politics, it has to do with his race, not with his income. Actually, I think the income stuff, John and Jeff, I think the income stuff shows you that the Democratic campaign is really running against the Republicans of George H.W. Bush. It's all about giving money to the rich and so forth. But that's not Trump's campaign. I mean, Trump has transformed the party, and it's just like they're saying it's all for the rich. But I think average working person doesn't think when George H.W. Bush said he liked to eat pork rinds,
right?
Which may have been true. I have no idea. It just didn't ring true to people. Right. But when Donald Trump puts on a hard hat or works in a at a McDonald's, it doesn't seem so fake. I mean, it seems like he can understand the struggles that people have. And of course, real income went up under him, at least until the COVID crisis. And it hasn't gone up under Biden, who is not going to appear anywhere on the campaign stage in the last 2 weeks of the campaign. He is not scheduled to appear anywhere.
What
if they could put him in, if they could put him in a mausoleum between now and then, they would do it.
Well, what can Kamala Harris do now? She's been found out to be a phony, a nincompoop, and a plagiarist.
Those stories. How many people have seen this stuff about the plagiarism? As if it, I don't think it matters all that much. I mean, I've written books about plagiarism, but I don't think it matters that much to voters. It killed Biden's campaign years ago, but
does it matter to them that she plagiarized Martin Luther King with the the little girl saying freedom. Remember that story?
Oh,
that she
yeah.
made up?
Yeah, yeah. And there's no evidence she ever worked at McDonald's and so forth. But I think what she's going to do is she's going to appear with the Obamas, Michelle as well, right. Uh-huh. And she's going to read her speeches from the teleprompter. She, in the last couple of days, she went off the teleprompter twice, and she made two humongous mistakes. One was she was heckled by people in the crowd who said, Jesus is Lord.
Right.
And she said, you're at the wrong rally. You need to be at the rally down the street. And the other was the Palestinian false claim that what's happening in Gaza is a genocide. You can say it's an excessive use of force. I don't think so, but I mean, you can say those things, but a genocide is a deliberate attempt to wipe out a whole population on the basis of its race, ethnicity, religion, or something. That's not what's happening. But these people have called Joe Biden Genocide Joe, and they're calling Kamala Killer Kamala. So this guy makes a protest, and as he's being escorted out of the thing, she says, but he has a real point. And so there's a reason. I mean, there's a feeling that if her teleprompter gave her Ron Burgundy's message, go F yourself, go F yourself, San Diego, she would just right. read it and not notice.
Right.
Does she recover, guys? Jeff, too, I would like to know, can she recover from saying to people, you're at the wrong rally, meaning we're not a Christian nation, I guess it means, right? Isn't that what it means?
I think what she probably meant was, what you would probably say is, I didn't hear them. I didn't hear what they were saying. Right. I just heard they were yelling exactly. against me. Yeah, and right. I told them to go to a different rally. That would be her best answer, which is not to say that would be her answer. Look, Trump doesn't give his best answers all the time right. either. He has stuck his foot in his mouth so many times.
Yeah, right. And I don't think anyone's any of the swing state independents are being swung at this point. You know, we know who's who.
Does it get baked in now? And there's no
well, it comes down to the ground games, I think. You know, this that's voter right. turnout and how good are they? And that was Trump's shortcoming in 2020. In the sense, especially when you look at that, we've talked about this, John, where how the Democrats were so good at using the Facebook that couldn't target specific campaigns, wink, wink, but did right. target, you know, was able to push and pull 1,000 people here and there to give them control of a state like Wisconsin. I mean, you're seeing that Trump supposedly, and he's everywhere. I mean, his name pops up in every ad drop, anything you search for, he's showing up. It looks like he's got a pretty good ground game, but I'll tell you, you know, I've got friends who are very progressive, live in the suburbs of the lush green suburbs of Chicago, and they think that they're being undercounted, kind of circling back to the polling earlier and mm-hmm. how close mm-hmm. it is. They think millennials and Zillennials, you know, that generation old, younger than them, are don't respond to these types of campaigns because they don't trust media because they've grown up not trusting mm-hmm. media for a little bit longer, right. a larger part of their life. And so the idea is that they don't think they're getting counted. And so it's – which I didn't – you know, didn't just, occur to me, but they feel that way. Like they wouldn't respond. These are people my age, you know, in their 40s and right, younger.
But they don't care that J.B. Pritzker is the governor of Illinois. I mean, they're not counted in – what, in polls or
in polling? They feel like when they see polling and stuff mm-hmm. that they're, you know, they don't think they would respond to that stuff, or they ignore that stuff when they get it. You know, they don't see it. They don't think younger people would be involved or be it's hard to target them unless it's like, you know, on TikTok or wherever they are, which, you know, they're not responding to random text messages and have more technology to block that type of stuff. it's just interesting that, that they think they're working. I mean, they've got a PTA's worth of moms who are cranking out thousands of postcards, handwritten postcards.
So this is a very important point, and it's really perplexing pollsters. How do you weight people who have a low propensity to answer polling questions? And then, of course, there's the traditional problem of how do you weight who's going to actually go and vote. This has been a problem. The who's going to go to vote is a problem in the past for Republicans. They are still at a disadvantage on the ground game and on the getting people out to vote, but they're at less of a disadvantage than they have been in the past. But about 10% of the people who think they're going to vote on election day don't actually vote. And since those people are disproportionately Republican as opposed to people who mail in their ballots, that is enough to swing various states. So it's very important for the Republicans to up their ground game if they're going to win these very close races.
Yeah, everyone's got to come out and vote. I mean, I'm going to say something that Jeff and Charles would be shocked at, but you know what? Mm-hmm. I'm really not a liberal Democrat anymore.
What?
And
knock me over with a feather.
Shocked at that.
I'm going to vote for, I don't want to violate any FCC thing, but I'm going to vote for Donald Trump, but I want everyone to come out. I don't want to remember this. Have we forgotten the red wave that didn't happen?
Right.
How did that happen?
Well, you know, I vote on the South Side in Chicago, and the last time it was I can't remember if it was a local election or a midterm. It wasn't a presidential election. I voted a day early in person, and it was like election day. I mean, there were just lots of people there, and I knew they weren't voting the same way I was, but I actually felt good just because, like you're saying, as a civic thing. Yeah, and I do, I must say, I find that this idea, I like the fact that in Chicago, of all places, there is a paper trail. So if there's a question about what happened, I mean, maybe ballots get lost, but assuming that they don't, we can double check what happened. There is every chance that that bad outside actors will try to hack anything that's online and so forth. It was really encouraging, didn't you think, to see the long lines in these hurricane ravaged areas of North Carolina where people were lined up to do their civic duty.
I don't think it was encouraging to Kamala Harris and the Democrats because most of them protest. I mean, I'm could be wrong. I could be wrong on all this, and I tell that all the time, and I want everyone to know that I don't know if I'm right 100% of the time.
Oh, I tell people that I could be wrong. I remember once in the late 1950s and maybe once in the mid 60s, but you know, it's, you know, so it could happen. Yeah.
Charles, I mean, one thing I want to ask you too about the piece you wrote. We're kind of turning, if we can, a hard pivot here, but the Middle East.
It was in the,
you had a piece in the Spectator World. Yeah, Spectator World.
Yeah.
And the headline was, "What follows Sinwar's death in Israel's war in Gaza and beyond. Nearly all Hamas senior leaders are dead. What comes next?" Charles?
I think that the right way to look at what Israel is doing, first of all, Sinwar was killed in the city of Rafah. Rafah is right on the border with Egypt. And Kamala Harris and Joe Biden repeatedly and vocally and publicly told Israel not to go in there to their credit, they congratulated the Israelis for doing it, for killing him. But if the Israelis had followed the Biden administration,
they never would have got him.
Yeah, right. They would never would have gotten him. What separates Gaza? The first thing to realize is that Israel is surrounded by enemies who are funded by Iran. And Iran, this is a long-term project of the Islamic Republic of Iran. But what Trump did, the most visible thing he did was he knocked out Soleimani, a prominent figure. But what was really damaging to this whole Iranian project was he enforced sanctions, and the Biden administration didn't. When Trump left office, Iran was broke, and that meant that Hezbollah and Hamas had to figure out ways to get their own money and so forth, and they were in much weakened shape. Biden has given them hundreds of billions of dollars, not yes. directly, but by not enforcing the sanctions. So what Israel did was, after the October 7th, 2023 attack, which killed like 1,200 innocent Israelis and captured over 200 hostages, the Israelis made, I think, a fundamental decision that Gaza could no longer, that Hamas could no longer exist, not just as a military, but as a political organization. They're a branch, by the way, of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. But if they weren't wiped out, completely wiped out, then they would not only be able to rule, and if they couldn't rule in Gaza, they would be able to prevent anybody else from ruling, would kill them, and so forth. What the Biden administration has wanted, which is a ceasefire, would have left them in place, and they could have rearmed from Iran, recruited new members, and continued to pose a threat. Now, how is Israel stopping that? It's doing it in two ways. It's wiping them out entirely, the best it can, and it is controlling the border area between Gaza and Egypt, which is called the Philadelphia Corridor, because under that corridor, there are hundreds of tunnels that the Hamas terrorists use to bring in weapons from Iran and people from Iran who could show them how to use the weapons and train them, and maybe North Koreans who could show them how to dig tunnels and so forth. So they've decided to do that. The problem that they have is ultimately who's going to govern Gaza, because no Arab state wants any part of it, and Israel doesn't trust any of the international organizations because they have been so anti-Israel. In the north, the day after Israel was attacked on October the 7th, Hezbollah, which is far better armed and controls all of southern Lebanon and is a major power in the Lebanese government and is a Iranian proxy, began firing thousands of missiles, which they have continued to fire at Israel, in effect backing Hamas. So what Israel began to do secretly some months ago, was to try to go in and begin to map out the area and so forth. It's just filled with tunnels and all the rest. And just as with Hamas, they put these tunnels underneath civilian buildings. And in one case, there's a tunnel that's basically right next to the UN observer post. Hezbollah was not supposed to be in this area for 20 miles next to the Israeli border, and they violated that. So what you're seeing now, and what that led to, all these rockets, was 60 to 80,000 Israelis had to leave where they lived in northern Israel and move into temporary houses in central Israel. But the main goal, in my opinion, this is just my opinion, the main goal of the Israelis in attacking Hezbollah is not just to get those people back into a safe place, into their own homes. I think they have a second goal, which may be even more important. When they attack Iran, and we don't know exactly when, and we don't know exactly what they'll hit, but when they attack Iran, the Israelis don't want to be fired upon by thousands of rockets coming in from immediately next door in Lebanon. Sure. So they have a dual goal. So that's how I see it. And there is, for that reason, the Israelis will wait until they have sufficiently degraded Hezbollah before they attack Iran, both in cyber space and kinetically. The role of the U.S. in this, besides trying their best to give Israel really bad advice, has been to supply Israel with some weaponry with constraints on its use. And recently, to the credit of the administration, they absolutely pounded the Houthis in Yemen, who have been blocking transit through the Suez Canal. That's an international waterway, but the Iranians have wanted to block it, and they work with the Houthis to do it. So this is a very dangerous situation.
We, I think most people of goodwill want Israel to continue. I don't believe in the from the river to the sea horse. You know, I don't want them to be hurt. No. I don't want to wipe out a people. They deserve the right to live. But as you're talking, I'm thinking, what is Saudi Arabia's role in all this? Because if, as we think, Iran is going to be attacked, what fills the vacuum from the Saudi Arabian side to benefit, you know, the civilized world?
Well, the Saudis are a family-ruled country, dictatorship. It was just Arabia. The Saudis are a family. It's like calling it Casamerica.
Right.
So,
which is what I call it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's why I pay my taxes, John.
Thank you.
Abraham Accords, which were peace agreements between Israel and some of the Arab Gulf states, were all really approved by the Saudis. And the Saudis were just waiting because they are the guardians of the holy places. They have important religious considerations that they don't want to undermine their regime. So they were moving slowly. But they would have signed a peace agreement with Israel, in my opinion, had there not been the October 7th massacre. And this is, by the way, the problem of post-war governance in Gaza is not something the Saudis want to play any role in. It's just, why sure. would they? And the same is going to be true in southern Lebanon. They will give money for reconstruction, but I would just say, but let me say the background of the Abraham Accords is different from what people think. What really happened there was that at one point the Iranians actually attacked the Saudi oil installation. I think maybe one of the biggest oil installations in the world.
Uh-huh.
And President Trump said, oh, this is a very bad thing. We don't like this at all, but did nothing.
Yeah.
And And that's kind of in keeping. I mean, you know, he uses threats and kind of pinpoint use of the military, and he creates enough uncertainty about whether he will use force that he can deter others. But once the Saudis realized that the Americans weren't going to come in to defend them, even when their oil installations were attacked, which is not to say that they might not defend them in the future, but the Saudis couldn't count on it. The Saudis began looking for who was the strong horse in the region who could oppose Iran. And that's obviously Israel. The only constraint is that if they cooperate too openly with Israel, they're not just a Muslim state, they're the Muslim state, the keeper of the holy places. So they have to be kind of cautious in any public endorsement of policies with Israel. But I think that the rationale for the Abraham Accords, which you may recall, the Biden administration never uses that word, just like they don't use illegal for immigrants and so forth. They don't want to give any credit where credit was due. But the real reason for that was Israel's great strength and America's unwillingness to defend the Saudis.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting, Charles. The situation as it stands now, then, where do you think Saudi Arabia lands? I mean, they've been buying up armament from like the Russians pretty heavily, too. I mean, they're buying, they're involved with everybody, pretty much, it sounds like. I mean, Kamala has no experience in it and hasn't shown anything remotely in any sort of, you know, diplomatic ability on an international scale. I mean, why isn't he doing more to point that out?
Well, because his main message is America first. Mm-hmm. His strongest line internationally is, when I was president, we started no wars. The world was calm. And now, under Biden-Harris, it's on fire. But I must say, I disagree with a lot of the Republicans, because I think it's in our American national interest to support the Ukrainians against the Russians. Now, I agree with Trump that the Europeans should play a much larger financial role in supporting them, but I think it's in our national interest. And I must say, I talk with a lot of Republicans behind the scene, knowledgeable Republicans, who just don't like that at all. No. So there are disputes. What's happened is that the Republican Party has changed dramatically from the days of Dwight Eisenhower. And it's even changed from the days of Reagan. Reagan began the shift toward a kind of Harry Truman party with a lot of working people. But he was an internationalist. Now, that was during the days of the Cold War. But he was an internationalist.
Right.
And Trump is much more protectionist, and he's much more nationalist. So I think that the Republican Party has changed, and the Democratic Party has changed with it. You've seen a kind of the Democratic Party looks more like a barbell, with one end of the barbell being Winnetka and the other end of the barbell being the West Side.
That's pretty good.
Well, I see the next 10, 15 days as a time of panic for the Democrats. I don't want Republicans to be complacent, because I see this election in existential terms. I see what the left has done to media. Charles points it out in a recent column where you talk about 60 Minutes and CBS is the once the Tiffany of networks. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's pathetic.
It really is. And they won't release the actual full transcript of what Kamala Harris said in the interview. We know that they did more than just edit it. They really mutilated it to help her. But even so, she didn't help herself. I mean, the media, according to some studies, gives the Democrats as much as a 5-point advantage. But sure. I think that's bound to have reduced in recent years, because I just think that the media is now fragmented. People who listen to Rachel Maddow are not much listening to John Cass, and vice versa. You know, I mean, you may listen to them because you enjoy the schadenfreude quality, but I mean, I think that the old days when you could be right, left, or center and listen to Milt Rosenberg on WGN,
oh, God bless them,
those days are gone, and the days of listening to Walter Cronkite. The bad news is that it has led to a more fragmented world. The good news is that you can't have Dan Rather just bury stories that his side would like to bury. So I think that there's, that, and you can see what, when Elon Musk, by the way, we hadn't talked about Elon Musk. What do you think about him, Jeff?
I'm not a fan of his. I mean, I know he's a, he's very good at PR, and he's a, you know, he's a carnival barker of sorts. I don't prefer his vision for the world. I mean, he's got this idea that the humanity's only hope is by fleeing a quote unquote dying planet for a planet that's already died, technically, that already had an atmosphere at one point, already had a magnetosphere. You know, and those things have all gone away for one reason or another. It's just weird. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. It's not logical.
What planet? Mars?
Mars. He says, yeah, he wants us to go to Mars. And you're like, that's our humanity's only hope is being interplanetary. And in reality, you know, humanity is strong enough to build, you know, something to fix the having too high CO levels in the CO2 levels in the air and warming temperatures and all these. We can adapt one way or another, but this idea that we need to spend all this money on going to Mars is like this end all be all.
Let me sort of push back on one word. We need to spend the money. The key thing for him is that it's his money. I mean, it's true. Not NASA's
it's his money, true, but a lot of his funding comes from government contracts. So, I mean, yes, true, but he's also selling this idea that, you know, we need all these micro satellites in space and, you know, we need no rules, and he needs to be able to set the rules. I mean, in my mind, he comes off much more as a Lex Luthor type than a Superman type. If we're tipping left or right on that.
I don't know that you can criticize an African-American like that.
South African-American.
If he had done what the left had expected him to do.
Yeah.
And just play along with Twitter. Just let them control the mind and the rhetoric and the dialogue on Twitter. He would have been fine. No one would be screaming at him that he was.
I mean, my opinion on him is predated anything his meddling with Twitter. I mean, he's a lot more bluster and blather than substance. I mean, he's not a guy who's writing the programs. He's not a guy who's sitting down here developing the engineering. He's not a guy who's writing the code and pushing the boundaries of technology, but he takes the credit for it. And that kind of drives me nuts. And he's like this guy that for some reason, you know, that everybody is latched onto because he's, you know, in the right place at the right time for a lot of things. And you don't do that without being prepared. There's no doubt. But he's just like much like Trump, you know, people think he's this like God and they do fan art for him and they worship everything he says and does. And at the end of the day, he's kind of just a pot smoking, you know, futurist. That's all he is.
I'm going to put you down as undecided.
And I'm going to go smoke a bowl and think of Foundation Earth or those horrid Asimov stories.
Oh, come on. I love Isaac Asimov.
Landing that booster,
yeah,
and catching
give
it.
Credit.
Oh man,
I mean, but that's fine. There's no doubt. But it's that company did that technology, that idea. It's not something he developed. He didn't come up with that concept. You know, I understand that. But It's amazing. There's no doubt. But there's so many smart engineers that he doesn't treat well, notoriously, well, for.
Well,
you know, comes in and yells at them and comes in at labs and is, you know.
But isn't it like, I mean, you know, what Thomas A. Edison invented,
sure,
was the research laboratory. It wasn't,
yeah,
that Thomas Edison created all those things, but I think it's an interesting point that you make. I think that the question now is whether Musk is a sufficiently a kind of attractive figure to help Trump with turnout and maybe turning things a little bit. Because Trump is, after all, an older figure. The person who's really surprised me in this election has been J.D. Vance. I was quite unsure, and his first couple of weeks were kind of rocky, but he is...
We talked to you right after. I remember we were very questioned.
But boy, he has come on, and I think Trump made the right call, although I think that in the whole election, if the candidate had been somebody like Glenn Youngkin, the Republicans would be sailing to an easy victory. But my hunch is that that Vance has helped him and will continue to help him. And now everything really looks like it comes down to the blue wall states, maybe plus Georgia and North Carolina. And it looks like... we're not sure about Nevada, but it looks like Arizona will likely go Republican. And
do you hear yourself, Charles? Do you hear yourself? That was, to me,
what a great line.
When he eviscerated,
yeah,
what's her name?
Martha Raddatz.
Oh, man, that was so perfect.
Awkward.
That's something that I would start smoking again. Don't tell Betty, because I would just like to roll over and have a cigarette.
Well, I posted something where it was an article I posted on Facebook where it said illegal migrants with alleged ties to bloodthirsty Venezuelan gang accused in hotel murder. That was the headline. And I posted it, and then under it I said, ABC's Martha Raddatz provides context. Most hotels don't have deadly gangs, and families of murdered guests will receive 1,000 bonus loyalty points.
Excellent.
These people have no shame. I mean, I think it's a big problem if you live in Washington or the Upper West Side. There was a famous movie critic, John will remember her, but right, before your time, Pauline Kael, who
I don't know anyone. Yeah, right.
Yeah, she said, oh, right. Give it the quote, John.
She said, "I don't know anyone who voted for Nixon."
Yeah, how could he have won? I don't know anybody who voted for him. And that's the problem that you have at CBS, ABC, CNN, all the rest. They're just in these bubbles. And, of course, people on the right are often, I mean, you know, the world of Sean Hannity and so forth. It's the same thing. You're in this bubble, and all you hear are the echoes of your own voice and your own opinion.
Well, strap in.
Strap in, gentlemen, and strap up, because it's going to be an interesting several weeks. And after the election, I hope we can have Charles back. Charles, can you come back to talk to us about how the Democrats, who've been screaming about election denialists, will now deny this election should they lose?
It should be, but I appreciate your quoting Betty Davis in some film where she said, "Buckle up, it's going to be a bumpy night."
Yes, it is.
Jeff Carlin, for you film aficionado. Thanks, Charles. Thanks for being here, and we'll get back to you after the election, and we'll see what happens, right?
It's great to talk to you. Thanks, Charles. I'm going off now to serve fries at McDonald's.
Always a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
For Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago, you can read all his stuff at charleslipson.com. And for Jeff Carlin, my friend, who cuddled with a cow, maybe we'll talk about that someday soon. He and Christine just love farm animals. And we haven't even talked about Jeff's passion for the Jeremy Clarkson show on Amazon, but we'll get to it. And for me, John Cass, editor-in-chief of John Cass News, and that column I edited about Tony Resco's groundskeeper. Join us again next time for another edition of the Chicago Way podcast on WGN+.